Park is world-renowned for the bucolic backdrop of trees and foliage that it provides amidst the sidewalks and skyscrapers of Vancouver. We'll talk about Stanley Park's secret past this morning with the renowned historian and best-selling author Jean Barman. Her new book is Stanley Park's Secret, The Forgotten Families of Woy Woy, Kanaka Ranch, and Brockton Point. It tells the remarkable story of how the park was created and how before it was officially opened in 1888, it was home to a number of settlements. From Aboriginal peoples living at Woy Woy, now Lumberman's Arch, to immigrant Hawaiians who settled in Kanaka Ranch, which is just located at the southeast portion of the park, and those who resided at Brockton Point, Barman provides a compelling, important, and sometimes troubling facet of Vancouver, not to mention British Columbia's history. Dr. Barman is, of course, the author of, among other things, the essential book on British Columbia history, The West Beyond the West. Stanley Park's Secret from Harbor Publishing is $36.95. Please welcome its author to thecommentary.ca, Jean Barman. Good morning, Professor Barman.
Good morning to you.
What compelled you to write this book, and why tell these stories of the people who once inhabited the park?
I didn't start out to write the book. Over the years, just through a lot of things that I do in terms of British Columbia history, descendants would get in touch with me, and they would say, why are we written out of the history? Why don't you talk about our lives through generations living in what would become Stanley Park, long before there was a park? And I would say, no, I don't think you can do this. It's too difficult. The sources aren't there. If they were there, I'd know about them. But eventually, I was persuaded about the third or fourth person that I met that maybe it was possible, and Stanley Park Secret as a result.
Now, the park itself was opened in 1888,
right.
And that was sort of, I guess, was that the city fathers who said, let's have this sort of park, this wilderness, we'll preserve that. People who live in the city in apartments and houses can go there and enjoy that for leisure or whatever. But that's a false ideal, is it?
Well, it's an idealism, and it, certainly everything you said is accurate to a point in the sense that the city fathers wanted people to have a place that they could enjoy that was idyllic, a little bit of a Garden Eden beside the, all of the noise and the hubbub of a young city just brought to being because of the Canadian Pacific Railway. But at the same time, the reasons they wanted it had to do not so much with the welfare, I think, of average people, average men, women, and families, as it did in their own interests, because most of the city fathers were also land developers. They were also big city promoters. And the fear was that this peninsula of almost 1,000 acres could be put on the market. At the moment, it was in the possession of the federal government, the Dominion government, and particularly the officials of the CPR, the Canadian Pacific Railway, which had created Vancouver by making it the western terminus. They were fearful because they had a whole lot of land in downtown Vancouver today and in the vicinity that they wanted to sell at the maximum price. So it was very important for everyone to keep this land off the market. And secondly, it was a great promotional tool to make people want to come and live in Vancouver and therefore to sell the property at higher prices than might otherwise be the case. And this is the time when urban parks were in fashion. You have Central Park in New York City. You have Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. You have just a whole lot of parks, Regent's Parks in London. They're all being formed by cities about the same point in time.
Now, at the time that the park was created, there were people living there, and there had been people living there from time immemorial, have there not?
Right. There had been Aboriginal people who certainly had made use of the park for resources and possibly lived there. It's impossible to know since time immemorial, to use the saying, when the first workers were creating the first road around Stanley Park in 1887. They turned up acres, piles 8-10 feet high of midden piles, which were essentially piles of clamshells and shelves, showing that the park had been used for a very, very long time. And the attitudes toward Aboriginal people at this point were essentially they were going to die out eventually because they were inferior, they were racially inferior, they were inferior in every other way. So what they did is they didn't use the shelves to say, this is Aboriginal site. What they did is they used it to pave the road. So Aboriginal people were still living. They were living at, you mentioned, Woy Woy, which is Lumberman's Arch, and there also were people living further west at Chasus, which is very close to Prospect Point. the other group of people were living around Brockton Point, and these were mostly gold miners who had arrived for the gold rush beginning in 1858 or the early 1860s. They had settled down with Aboriginal wives. A lot of their wives were Squamish, just as the people who were living at Hoi Hoi and Chasus were. So essentially, these were people who were indigenous to the area, to the peninsula of Stanley Park.
You talk about these indigenous people using the park, utilizing the park. Who exactly owned the park at that time?
Well, this is one of the most interesting things that came out of the research. It's been accepted, wholeheartedly accepted, that it was made a government reserve in 1859 because it was feared the Americans were going to attack. There had been a controversy over San Juan Island. And the assumption was that it was officially made a government reserve. But when you look for the records to find this out, you simply don't find it. And it's not only myself who looked in London, looked in Victoria, and looked in Ottawa, but various people working for governments have looked in the past. And so the assumption was it was a government reserve. The province thought that it had inherited it when British Columbia joined Confederation in 1871. But then in 1880, the Dominion Government of Canada requested from Britain all the lands that had been taken for defense purposes during British Columbia's colonial years and had not been returned. When you look in the records in London, what you find out is that the British government searches high and low for 4 years saying, why do we own, how did we get this piece of land? And there are other lands involved as well. How did we get any of these pieces of land? We have no record. We have them. And in 1884, the British government simply threw up its hands and said that we have no record of these lands ever coming in our possession. And, you know, if you want them, you can have them back on the same basis. And so from that point on, the federal government thought that it owned the peninsula, and that was why it was willing to let there be a park, was persuaded that there should be a park.
So that was 1888?
The park is made officially in 1887, but the decision, the British government willingness to say we have no interest in these, in the peninsula, and therefore if you want it, you can have it, and since it, you know, it's up to you what you do with it, that was in 1884. So this is a fairly small period of time when people are vying for the peninsula.
Now, people are still living there.
They continue to live there.
Up to 1888 and then to 1958, right?
Well, the last person who's lived in the park in continuous possession from the early 1860s through his family and living in the same place, yeah, dies there in 1958.
That's Cumming, is it?
Someone called Tim Cumming or Cummings, yes. And he was living, the houses at Brockton Point were both on the north and the south shore of where the totem poles are now, and he was living in a cottage on the north shore, right just north of the totem poles, facing North Vancouver.
Now that's a fascinating story, and I want to ask you about that, because
sure.
When he dies in 1958, there is some question as to whether or not his shack, his house, should be preserved. George Peel plays a bit of a cameo in that, right?
Exactly. And George Peel says that it is hideous. He votes and leads the Parks Board. He was chair of the Parks Board. He leads the Parks Board decision so that about 3 years, it's been dickering. They've been dickering about 3 years after he says it should be torn down. Yeah. And I should add that yesterday I did an interview on the Bill Good Show and made this point, and George Peel phoned up and basically reiterated what had happened, and I got what happened from the newspaper, but he confirmed what happened, and he actually took great pride in it and suggested that in his best recollection, he was a member of a rugby club, one of the many clubs at Brockton Point, and that they were the ones who had towed the house into the water and apparently sunk it.
Really?
And I didn't know that until yesterday morning.
Well, that's fascinating, isn't it?
A fascinating aside. And I think that is also important because it does indicate this kind of chasm that existed in terms of whose park was it, who was it for, because one of the first things that happens once Stanley Park is made a park is that the whole area of Brockton Point is leased to the Sporting Fraternity of Vancouver, which are essentially all of the businessmen who want to do amateur sports, and they were given a lease to all of Brockton Point, which was literally the families are living on the shore, and all of the rest of Brockton Point is leased to these sporting fraternities, which still exist there, and which is what, you know, in the tradition of which George Peel was talking. And they felt that they had a really almost inherent right to the park because they were essentially, you know, the city fathers.
Now, the people that lived in the park, you talked about Aboriginals.
Mm-hmm.
There were Hawaiians. There were Chinese.
Right.
There were Chileans as well, if I'm...
There's no Chileans who actually live in the park. They live on the North Shore. But there were people, a lot of people who are Portuguese.
What were the race relations like between them? And an add-on to that question,
sure,
to the greater society.
Well, what happens at this point in time is that people who are Aboriginal are, you know, the assumption for a long time is that they're going to disappear of their own accord. Now, the people who are living at, and it was easier, in fact, to get rid of the, you know, the Squamish people who were living at, who are living at Woy Woy, living at Lumberman's Arch, and living further west. But for the families at Brockton Point, they were newcomer men, they were white men who had married Aboriginal women in the first generation, and so their children were mixed race, what was termed derogatory at the time, half breeds. And they were people that I think most Vancouverites wanted to pretend didn't exist. They didn't know what to do with them. They were a legacy of the past. There had, for a long time in British Columbia, there were far fewer white women than there were white men, and so it was recognized that some men had been forced to have families by Aboriginal women. But everyone pretended that this was part of the past, and this, ironically, I think is one of the reasons why the family stayed so long, because no one could quite understand who they were. They had no categories in which to put them.
You've talked to a lot of families in the process of putting this book together, writing
right.
this book. What's the reaction been to the book?
So far, in fact, it's not just talking to the family since I wrote it. In the course of writing it, I was, you know, introduced and talked to a number of descendants, and I, in an intermediate stage, I sent to descendants the portions I had written about them and their family to make sure that there were no, you know, there were no errors and I had not misrepresented them. And nobody said that I had. Everyone was very happy, and subsequently, people who've read the book since I published it have been very happy. They've been very content, and I think they feel that finally, you know, they have a voice in the past. They have part of their time in Stanley Park recognized, that the park, hopefully, will be seen more generally as having, you know, a richer and more complex history. And I don't think this doesn't change, certainly, the fact that we all love Stanley Park. We love to go to Stanley Park, but what happens, what exists at the present time is that we are given a certain history of Stanley Park. We all know about the Shakespeare Garden. We know about the statues to the Queens or the statues to Lord Stanley. So we're given a kind of British-oriented take on Stanley Park, as if that is, in fact, the entirety of the park. And what hopefully this book will do will, you know, expand that history and just give us all the ability to see the park in a more complex and a more realistic way if we choose to do so. And I think this is one of the goals, and this is what persuaded me to undertake the research in the first place.
I jumped ahead a bit. In terms of the family, when they talked to you about writing their story, was there a bitterness, was there resentment because their stories had been forgotten?
I think there is some bitterness, sure there's resentment. I would be very resentful, and the more I found out, the more resentful I think that I have become on their behalf. It's not just that they've been excised. I mean, the minute that they were, the last of the families was removed, and that's the George Peel story we talked about a bit, there was an attempt to remove any indication they'd ever been in the park. And as far as I can find nothing in the park except for there's a tiny, tiny plaque to Chase's that's hidden away on the beach just east of Brockton Point, or rather east of Prospect Point, but other than that, there's nothing there. But I think what happens when I did the research is that the basis on which the families were removed is problematic.
We're talking with the author, Jean Berman, about her latest book, Stanley Park Secret, The Forgotten Families of Woy Woy, Kanaka Ranch, and Brockton Point, $36.95 from Harbor Publishing. At the beginning of the interview, you said that you were apprehensive about writing this book because there were a lack of sources. How long did it take you to write this book? And I ask that because in reading it, you use a lot of oral histories, a lot of archival documents, Parks Board records, court proceedings, and the sort. So how long did it take you to write the book, and how did you come up with some of the material that you used in the book?
I think one of the things that happens for those of us who are historians and those of us who look for documents is part of it is idiosyncratic, and part of it is just a lot of digging. The first people who talked to me almost a dozen years ago, and I did nothing about it. I did nothing about it until the late 1990s when a very forceful 90-year-old woman not only talked about 3 hours but needing to write their story, but then she gave me at the end a computer disk where she had written down everything that she knew, and that was what caught me and snagged me. So since then I started looking. And to my surprise, I discovered that there are records of the court cases, the dispossession cases. There are records in the Department of Indian Affairs of the ways in which the families, the Squamish families, were refused to reserve in 1876. And one of the families, one of the men who had been a child grown up in the park, Willard Gonsalves, who I was told to go and see, and I went and talked to him, and he was quite elderly. And as I was walking out the door, he said, "Well, don't you want the transcript of the trial?" I said, "What? There's a transcript of the trial?" He said, "Oh, yes, my father was the main defendant, and he always kept it." And he went into the back room, and he handed me a typed transcript of the dispossession trials in the early 1920s. And that's the kind of, you know, good luck that we'd all like to have in our research. One of the major reasons, one of the major sources, though, is Major James Matthews, who was the first Vancouver City archivist, who during the 1930s interviewed, talked to as many early Vancouver residents as he could find. And while he was very keen on talking to people who were sort of important, you know, put in politics or economics, he also was very determined to talk to ordinary people. And he talked to a number of the individuals who had lived in Stanley Park, and those interviews are absolutely invaluable. I mean, not just for this book, but for anybody who wants to understand the history of Vancouver.
One of the things that I took a couple of social history courses at UBC in the last couple of years. They talk about the reliance of oral history.
Mm-hmm.
How do you test the reliance of what someone says who was there?
One of the main things I do is I've done this. I've written a couple of other books also based in oral data in part. Is that first of all, you have to accept that most people don't deliberately lie to you. They tell you what is in their head, what they remember, and what they remember. In some cases, the timing is off. They remember something is happening in a different sequence than it actually happened. We all do this, or we put several events together in our head and we put them together into a single event. But what it does is it gives us, as historians, very important both clues, and if we take that as data, then we can also put together with other kinds of data and see whether, in fact, there is some consistency between what someone is telling us orally. We can look at vital statistics and see when people were married and when they died. We can look at city directories. There's a whole range of, you know, generally available sources that can have confirmed some of the really basic touchstones in what someone says when they talk. And the other thing we do, of course, is that what I've tried to do over time, and that's talk to a number of individuals about a similar time period or a similar event, and particularly individuals who don't know each other and who approach it differently. So, you know, the sources are not contaminated. What happens, though, and there's no way to avoid this, is that repeatedly over time I've heard versions of events and I thought, this is so wonderful, it confirms what I know. And then by probing a bit more, which we always have to do as to, you know, how was someone linked to the events they're describing, I discovered that the information came from me in the first place.
Really?
And it's always, you know, there's a danger. I mean, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right when you say that we can't take oral evidence as being factual. But on the other hand, if we want to get perceptions of real people in the past, it's sometimes the best that we have.
And it's a fascinating, the way that you put the book together and you tell the stories of the people. You want to know what happened to this person. You want to know what happened to that person. Where is their family today and the sort. So I guess the last question I want to ask is,
sure.
In writing this book, do you think how the city grew. But more than that, as a society, do you think that we've evolved in terms of how we relate to one another, in terms of who we are, race, and the sort of, even the race as a construct? And in that sense, do you think that the city remembers, I guess, the history in Stanley Park a little bit more because of the book?
Well, I'm very hopeful that it will. We'll see, and that's always where, you know, we don't know when the jury is out. But I'm very hopeful because it's not a, you know, it's not a book that's meant to be accusatory, or but it is, as you said, you've just said it very perceptively. I think what happened during this period of time from about 1860 when the first newcomers came to 1958 and then later on into the present, it's a reflection of the ways in which we see each other, and certainly, you know, the racism that we had, which was so endemic in the past, ideally it's receded. And you can, again, the book shows you how this happens, because the people that they could remove from the park just without any hesitation at all in the 1880s were the Chinese. And they were able to use the health card and say that their health, the conditions in which they were living in the park were unhealthy, and therefore they had to be removed. And that was very easy for them to do. And that sort of shows you how, in fact, you know, the Chinese were just so susceptible to any kind of external pressure, and there was no sensitivity whatsoever, even less so, I think, than with the Aboriginal people or with mixed-race people. And so I think, yeah, I think that what happened in the park is a really good way to think about how we have related to each other in changing ways through time.
Professor Berman, thanks so much.